asking for cooperation from the nuclear genie.
Genie, come on out.
Good morning, Master.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to ask a favor of you.
Oh, thank you, Master.
You haven't heard what it is yet.
We must stop the spread of nuclear weapons and seek the goal of a world without them.
At the United Nations, world leaders talk about or ignore nuclear proliferation, dreaming of that nuclear genie back in the bottle. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
References to anything and everything in American sitcoms, don't you think? Good morning. It's Thursday, September 24th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. There's plenty of references to Pittsburgh in American sitcoms. World leaders are gathering there now for the G20 summit. We're going to talk about that and complaints about mobile phone service. I bet there is a lot of them, but things could be changing if the FCC passes some new laws.
But first, Hans Blix joins us. He served as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency from 81 to 1997. He later led the UN committee charged with searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Hans Blix, can the United Nations realistically get that nuclear genie back in the bottle?
Well, it's clear that the knowledge how to make nuclear weapons is indestructible, but the hardware can be reduced in numbers and also in how many own them. At the peak of the Cold War, there were about 55,000 nuclear weapons, and there is now a bit over 20,000, perhaps. So the question now is, can we start going down towards zero? And it certainly will take many years, and the UN will be indispensable in the process.
Getting down towards zero, that's our discussion. Hans Blix, stay with us. We're going to talk more about nuclear proliferation in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, President Obama will address those nuclear issues next hour at the UN. Then he turns to the economy. He'll head to Pittsburgh to host the G20 Economic Summit. Leaders will talk about how to kickstart the global economy without repeating the mistakes that led to the global meltdown. There's interesting news in AIDS research. Scientists say a new vaccine may cut the risk of HIV infection by nearly a third. It's the first time we've had a vaccine that actually prevents infection.
Residents in flood-soaked Georgia are returning home today. The southeast flooding is receding, but a massive cleanup job is left to do. Senate Democrats could get a boost from Massachusetts Democratic Governor Deval Patrick today. He's expected to name his pick to fill Ted Kennedy's seat in a news conference later on this morning. In Kentucky, the FBI is investigating the death of a census worker. A law enforcement official says the man was found hanged in a remote forest area earlier this month, and the word Fed was marked on his chest. Wall Street dipped about 1% yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.49. The S&P starts trading at 10.61. And the Nasdaq begins at 21.31. After trading down all morning, futures trading suggests that Wall Street will have a flat to positive opening when trading gets underway in about an hour and a half from now. But meanwhile, the world leaders descend on Pittsburgh for the G20 summit. That could move the markets. But we're asking you a question. What would you do if they came to your town? What would you do with those leaders? Would you invite them over for dinner?
No, I'd probably get Calderon to serve me some good Mexican food.
Oh, my God. You're going to get emails on that one. Uh-oh. Welcome the world leaders or tell them to get lost. Your message at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are giving you the opportunity.
I'm from Southern California. I want some good Mexican food.
Is Calderon a cooker?
I don't know, but I'm sure he can get it. He's got a staff.
He's got people.
He can order. Come on now.
My people will help you out there, Celeste.
Some real salsa, please.
8778 My Take. Give leaders a piece of your mind.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. President Obama has made nuclear proliferation a major theme of conversation at the UN this week. Here's Obama speaking yesterday morning at the UN General Assembly.
For decades, we averted disaster, even under the shadow of a superpower standoff. But today, the threat of proliferation is growing in scope and complexity. If we fail to act, we will invite nuclear arms races in every region and the prospect of wars and acts of terror on a scale that we can hardly imagine.
Very dire language from the president. He did, though, make some progress on a couple key issues. He got a concession from Russia to consider tough new sanctions against Iran. That's a biggie. And also secured support from Moscow and Beijing for a Security Council resolution to curb nuclear weapons. That's a pretty big deal as well. Nuclear proliferation remains on the agenda today. President Obama is going to make a little bit of history. He's going to chair a UN Security Council meeting on disarmament. This is the first time a U.S. president has chaired a Security Council summit since it was established in 1946. I'm here now with Hans Blix. He was the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency from 1981 to 1997. And Mr. Blix led the UN committee that was eventually charged with finding weapons of mass destruction, or at least looking for them, in Iraq. We're also joined by Joe Cerencioni. He's president of the Anti-Nuclear Plowshares Fund and wrote the book Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. So, Mr. Blix, let's talk a little bit about this new focus at the United Nations on nuclear arms. Why are we suddenly hearing about nuclear weaponry again? Is it just because of North Korea and Iran?
Yeah, that's part of the explanation, but it's also a realization that the Cold War is over since a good long time, and that it's absurd to spend $1,400 billion a year around the world on arms at the present time. Iran and North Korea are the acute matters, but we are unlikely to come to grips with that problem unless also the P5, who have the 25,000 nuclear weapons today, unless they begin to disarm.
Well, he did, as I said earlier, make a couple little steps towards progress. How big a deal is it to get Russia to say that they'll consider sanctions against Iran and for Moscow and China to support a resolution to curb nuclear weapons?
Well, on the Iranian issue, I think that the focus in the Western world has been perhaps too much on the sanctions. It's always on the whip and not so much on the carrots. But if you want to get a country to act in a particular direction, then the carrots are as important. And it's instructive to compare the attitude that's taken to North Korea on the one hand and Iran on the other. In the case of North Korea, they are offered diplomatic relations both with the U.S. and Japan if they scrap their nuclear program. They're also offered security guarantees. None of these elements have been so far been raised publicly as regards to Iran. So I think that one should focus equally upon the carrots that can be given to Iran, not just the whips.
What do you think the global mission is, Hans Blix, on stopping nuclear proliferation? You spoke that since the Cold War ended, that the numbers of nuclear weapons have actually declined, and that's progress. Of course, that's actions that really were taken by the Russians and the Americans, you know, on their own. But nevertheless, we've also got nuclear nations like Israel and Pakistan that are very, very controversial. Does the stopping of nuclear proliferation constitute merely a freeze at this point now? Everyone who's got them, you got them, and no additional nations? Or does there have to be some sort of rollback and relinquishing of nuclear weapons, more on the scale of what the superpowers have done, for this to really stick?
Well, the basic bargain was made in 1968 and with the non-proliferation concluded. And the gist of that was that the non-nuclear weapons states should stay away from them and that the nuclear weapons states should go away from them. But then we had the Cold War over all this period, and the numbers grew to 55,000. And the Cold War is over, and it's time then to reduce, which the superpowers have done. And they've gone down considerably, but they've done away with the redundancy. And, of course, what we now want is to get down to zero, which will take a long time, many, many years. And Obama said he didn't think it would happen in his lifetime. But we have to start somewhere, and that is, I think, what Obama has done very well.
So, Joe Cerencioni, you're the president of the Plowshares Fund, which is an anti-nuclear group. You were also an informal advisor to the president during his campaign, correct?
Correct. That's right.
So what can you tell us about President Obama's nuclear policy and how that was developed? What is he hoping to accomplish on the nuclear arms race?
President Obama sees this as one of the great threats to human life on the planet. He has a personal interest in this. He took it on as a cause, as a young man, and then as a senator, reaching out to Republicans, Richard Lugar and Chuck Hagel, who were experts on these issues in the Senate. He always saw that you needed to have a bipartisan consensus on this. He thinks of nuclear weapons as one of the two great planetary threats, along with global warming, that can cause catastrophes on a planetary scale. So he's the one who keeps bringing this up, and you heard him just yesterday at the UN talk about his four pillars. And the very first pillar for security that he mentioned was nuclear proliferation and disarmament. He sees these as two sides of the same coin. You have to get disarmament, that is, reductions in the existing nuclear stockpiles, in order to get the international security. You need to stop the spread of these weapons. You need to stop the spread of these weapons in order to get the security that you need to convince people to continue to disarm. He's pushing on both sides of that coin, and I think he's got exactly the right policy.
Joe, I hate to be contentious here, but I'm just wondering how much that differs from policies in the past. There's been every president, even during the Cold War, has argued against nuclear proliferation. I mean, the superpowers, principally the United States, led us into this deal with a nuclear devil that Hans Blix talked about just a moment ago. It seems to me the superpowers are going to have to lead us out. That calls for unilateral action, for Obama saying, get rid of nukes altogether. America's going to begin. That's not likely, is it?
Well, you're absolutely right. Every president since Truman has called for the elimination of these weapons, including Ronald Reagan, who wanted to make them impotent and obsolete. What's different is that Obama is calling for this vision and coupling it with a concrete program of how to get started step by step. And he's not doing it unilaterally. He's doing it with the Russians. He says, we have to start. The United States and Russia own 96% of all the weapons in the world. So the U.S. has about 10,000, Russia has about 12,000. We have to take the first steps. He's right about that, and he's acting on it. We have one treaty underway with the Russians. The plan is to quickly go to another treaty that might get us down to, say, 1,000 weapons each.
Okay, but the complicator here, Hans, is that we have these very difficult situations with Iran and North Korea. And Ahmadinejad was at the United Nations yesterday. He said it's not possible to humiliate nations and impose double standards on the world community. It's necessary to delegitimize and reject any approach that views the realization of the interests of certain powers as the only measurement of democracy. So clearly, he is not accepting either anything coming out of Washington or out of Moscow or from the United Nations as dictating to him whether or not he can develop nuclear weapons.
Well, in negotiations, you don't really take no for an answer. I mean, before most negotiations, it's normal that the sides take very stiff positions. And the Western side has taken a very stiff position against Iran and said that, look, we will sit down and talk to you, but first you must freeze, you must suspend your enrichment program. I think Obama has been very wise in saying that, no, we are ready to meet, we are ready to listen to you, and unless they sit down together, I don't think they can prod each other and see really what could be a joint solution. The Iranians say that, no, there is no way we'll talk about enrichment, and the USA will talk about the enrichment. So I think let them meet, and they will meet. And I think the situation is therefore more hopeful now than it was a couple of months ago.
So what does President Obama need to say at the Security Council meeting that he's chairing today to reach countries like Iran or North Korea?
I would say he needs to have incentives and pressures, have that balance. And that's what he's embodied in the UN Security Council resolution that you're going to pass. What you're seeing is Obama step by step start to institutionalize his anti-nuclear vision, his view of how you go step by step with the other countries to both reduce the nuclear arsenals and increase the barriers to other countries and secure material so that terrorists can't get a single nuclear weapon, can't get an ounce of nuclear material. He has a very concrete and strong plan for how to do this. He's been remarkably successful in the few 9 months that he's been in office. I don't think any president has made this much progress in this short a time.
So, Hans, last word from you briefly. Are we going to see some serious progress in the months ahead?
Well, I hope so. At any rate, I think they put themselves in a position where they can discuss it. And certainly I would disagree with anyone who says that diplomacy is exhausted. No, I think diplomacy is really beginning now.
Hans Blix served as Director General of the IAEA from 1981 to 1997 before he was tapped to lead the UN committee that was eventually charged with searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He joined us from Sweden. We also heard from Joe Cirincione, president of the Anti-Nuclear Plowshares Fund. He wrote the book Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and he served as an informal advisor to Obama during the president's campaign.
You're listening to The Takeaway. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now some quick takeouts on stories that we're following this week. We'll start with Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd. It was supposed to happen by Friday, all of this being done. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. What's going on with the health care amendments?
Well, it was supposed to happen by Friday in the Finance Committee. They spent most of yesterday dealing with Medicare, which is the federal health program for 44 million seniors. You know, can they pare back spending to control costs? Can they do all that without affecting seniors' benefits, which would be a political disaster? And it's very complex. It's like clockwork, you know. When you mess with Medicare, you mess with the overall health care system, and the price of the overall health care system affects Medicare. And Max Baucus wants to get all this done by the end of the week, like you said, and he's kind of asking senators to go on faith a little bit about exactly how much each of the changes cost and what the legislative language is, because getting that exact language takes weeks, and the exact cost down to the dollar takes weeks. Baucus says we don't have time. Republicans really want to slow this thing down, and tensions sort of boiled over a little bit yesterday. Listen to this.
I want to do my job. And our job is to sit here and do it as long as it takes.
Maine Republican Olympia Snow there, the only Republican
sounding
Democrat.
Irritated.
A little irritated, and you might have heard her finger banging into the table. You know, she's the only Republican that the Democrats really care about right now, because she's the only one who has a prayer of getting onto this bill, and she's not on it yet. If she's really, really mad about process, that's not a good sign. So they don't want to start off this thing with Olympia Snow mad about process.
And
so,
I can't imagine Olympia Snow really accepting very much on faith. How fast can this thing realistically move, or when is this all going to end?
The overall cost of this bill was the only thing that ever mattered to her, so she won't go on faith. They wanted to have this out of committee by Friday. That is starting to look really unlikely. I think we're going to be dealing with this over the weekend, if not into next week.
Clockwork, Todd. Forgive me for not setting my watch by the U.S. Senate, okay?
Todd Zwillick is our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
Pleasure.
We're joined now by Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Of course, in Pittsburgh, the G20 sit down to begin to deal with, further implications of the financial crisis. The last time they got together, it was all about stimulus packages and making sure their interest rates were coordinated. Louise Story, what's on the agenda with the G20 this morning and, 6 months later?
Good morning, everyone. So there are a couple competing issues on the agenda. We've talked before about the bonus issue that a lot of Europeans are pushing. But the Secretary of the Treasury here in the U.S., Tim Geithner, has something else that's really on his agenda, and that's capital rules, bank capital rules. These are sort of the rainy day fund for banks, and they've really been at the root of the crisis. So he's hoping to push progress on that.
Well, let me sort of get an explainer on that. We got just about a minute and a half, but when you talk about capital rules, Geithner wants all the banks in the world to have to back their loans with a certain amount of actual money in the bank, right? And right now it's all over the map.
Right. So he wants them all to increase the amount of capital that they're holding, and it's based on a percentage of their assets. When you saw all the write-downs at the banks over the last couple years, $10 billion here, $20 billion there, those billions just started adding up. The reason they were a problem is that the banks didn't have enough capital to make up for those losses, and that's really why we had the bailout. So, what the bailout money is more capital for these banks. So that's why he's focused on it. He's lived the last 2 years and seen everyone panic in the markets as the banks didn't have capital. And so that's what he's pushing for. But he's going to have a lot of tension with the Europeans, because actually European banks tend to have more leverage, and this might be a bigger adjustment for them. And there's also a saga that goes back over capital rules, to the 1990s, where Europeans and Americans haven't agreed. So it might not be as easy as he hopes.
Very quickly, there's a note of optimism this morning. The Financial Times led with this story yesterday. Those collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, the so-called toxic assets, they're actually being unwound at a faster, more productive rate than people thought, which is taking bad assets out of bank portfolios. Will the G20 be talking about that?
I don't know if they'll get into that kind of detail, but part of the reason that they're being unwound relates again back to this capital, because banks unwind them in part when they don't have all the capital set aside, or what they call collateral, to absorb the losses. And so you can kind of view the unwinding as a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. I guess it's like much of banking, right?
Right. Yes, indeed. A good thing or a bad thing. Well, capital rules will be on the agenda at the G20. It's a theme of all kinds of stuff, implications of the financial crisis. Louise Story, thanks so much. New York Times finance reporter in Washington.
And now we're joined again by Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, we're going to talk about Michael Vick.
It's very exciting to have an opportunity to go out there and just play football, you know, regardless of my role, regardless of what I'm going to be doing this week, just to suit up and be able to go out and play in the game when it counts.
So Michael Vick will be hitting the gridiron against the Kansas City Chiefs this Sunday, but he's not going to be starting as quarterback, right?
So let's roll back. And earlier this week, the Miami Dolphins played again in the Monday night game, and they played an offense called the Wildcat offense against the Indianapolis Colts. The traditional quarterback offense is where the quarterback lines up, he goes back, he hands the ball to a running back, or he passes it to a wide receiver. In the Wildcat offense, you have three guys lined up behind the center, and the center snaps the ball to any one of those three individuals, and those people sometimes are going in motion, opposite directions. It's a very confusing offense for defenses to play. Now, I mention that because Michael Vick, last week the Eagles played 12 plays of that Wildcat offense.
Interesting.
They threw it into their playbook a little bit because they know what kind of guy they have behind there. Michael Vick may or may not play. Kevin Cobb, who started last week, will play. Most likely he will start. Donovan McNabb still has this fractured rib, and he can't
He's the Philadelphia quarterback.
Exactly, yep. Correct, sorry. And he still doesn't have the mobility that they need for him to produce at the high level. Cobb will be able to go in. Kevin Cobb, the backup quarterback, will be able to go in and do the traditional thing. But when you get, if you can get Michael Vick back there with the other running backs for Philadelphia, then you have a very dangerous option. Because in Miami, the backs who play that in the Wildcat position don't have the background of being a quarterback. All of a sudden, so you have an option of running one way or the other way. Now you have an option, a third option with Michael Vick, where he can get the ball and he can drop back and do the traditional thing, or he can go into the Wildcat offense. It's extremely, extremely dangerous with Michael Vick. And I think I mentioned this earlier back in the season, that if whoever brings him, I thought that Michael Vick should have went to Miami because they have the Wildcat. But whoever brings, now that they have him with Philadelphia, it makes their offense deadly. And they're already scoring points without Donovan McNabb at 100%.
It's like having two cannons, right? You've got a double passing threat in the back. It's almost irresistible.
Because it's an option passing threat, now if some people are familiar with the traditional option offense, it gives the quarterback the ability to make a decision at the last moment. Now this gives the quarterback an extra decision ability, and it makes Philadelphia extremely
nice
dangerous.
Nice to have options.
Okay, Ibrahim, sports contributor. All right, for the Takeaway, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much for coming in this morning. Coming
Good morning.
Up, a view of how the G20 looks from Pittsburgh. We'll take in scenes from the Steel City.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll go to Pittsburgh as the city prepares for the G20 summit there. First, some of the news stories we're following this morning at 32 minutes after the hour. Next hour, President Obama chairs a UN Security Council meeting. The meeting targets the spread of nuclear weapons. Later, he heads to that G20 summit in Pittsburgh. And in health news, scientists say they've developed a vaccine that may cut the risk of HIV infection by nearly a third.
Market-moving economic news just breaking this morning. The Labor Department in its weekly job report shows that new claims for unemployment down 21,000 to 530,000. It was an unexpected drop and also continues a trend on continuing claims. They're also down. Futures trading is now up. Wall Street expected to open positively in about an hour from now. Wall Street dipped about 1% yesterday. The S&P and the NASDAQ begin at 1061 and 2131, respectively. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
There's a pawn shop on the corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And I walk up and down neath the clock.
Leaders from the world's largest economies are now meeting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for the start of the G20 summit.
Pittsburgh has really transformed its economy. It's a vibrant city. It's got an incredible amount of civic pride. Beautiful. I think the delegates are going to be blown away by Pittsburgh.
That's Pennsylvania's Governor Ed Rendell talking up the city of Pittsburgh. And on the agenda at the summit, they're going to talk about how to fix the struggling global economy. They'll also be talking about bank reform and climate change, of course. But out in the streets of Pittsburgh, Steel City residents are preparing for the possibility of violent protests. Joining us now for a review from the ground is Global Post correspondent Cindy Skrzycki. Good morning, Cindy.
Hello, good morning.
So have we seen more protesters showing up? You said earlier this morning that it was a little bit quiet. Is there more going on?
You know, it was pretty quiet overnight and this morning as well. Most of the action is with delegates coming in at the airport, and action is really shifting about 6 miles south of downtown to the university area, which is called Oakland. And right now, in the next probably 30 minutes, much of Oakland near the Phipps Conservatory, where the working dinner is going to be held tonight, is being sealed off. In fact, police around there who I spoke to said that the Border Patrol on horses is going to be surrounding the Phipps and the park. The Phipps sits on a huge park called Shenley Park. So the bridges to there and everything will be shut down. There was a very small protest at Carnegie Mellon, which the university allowed, about free education. But there are other protests planned for Oakland this afternoon and also for an adjoining neighborhood, which has a lot of national chains that protesters often have something to say about. So business owners there were very busy yesterday boarding up their windows and basically shutting down. As far as downtown goes, it is in complete lockdown. Many of the streets that I think people didn't even expect to be shut down are, because Pittsburgh has its new commercial buildings, because of its emphasis on energy efficiency and green architecture, are glass. So many of those streets are shut down. High fences are up with barbed wire, and I'm sure Pittsburghers have never seen anything quite like this.
So they're taking the threat of violent protest pretty seriously. Pittsburgh is anybody getting to work? I mean, how are they getting down to
no
those?
No one's getting to work. I think Pittsburghers are pretty laid back about this, and they see this as kind of 2 days to prepare for the next Steelers game. I'm not kidding. You know, the students at the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, have been given off tomorrow, today, so there isn't much student traffic here, and there are two major events being held with world leaders at the University of Pittsburgh, so that also is going to cause more shutdown in this area, and people surely are not going to work. None of the parking lots are open downtown. There are
only 3 days
off
for the people in Pittsburgh. Thanks so much, Cindy Skrzycki, a Global Post correspondent on the ground in Pittsburgh. Let's talk now to Michael Goldfarb from London, also a correspondent for the Global Post. This is what President Obama had to say last week in his web address.
At next week's G20 summit, we'll discuss some of the steps that are required to safeguard our global financial system and close gaps in regulation around the world, gaps that permitted the kinds of reckless risk-taking and irresponsibility that led to the crisis.
Michael, you've covered these summits before. Do you expect President Obama is going to be able to accomplish some of these things he's talking about?
Probably not. You have to understand that, you know, if you have a global crisis and then you have individual governments, how is it possible to really close gaps? There's bound to be someone somewhere who will not cooperate. You know, it's been difficult enough on great global issues like nuclear disarmament. The global financial crisis is something else altogether, so I'm very skeptical.
So what about all of those who are head of these banks, these traders? Are they watching? Are they nervous about what reforms may go forward?
Well, you know, when the G20 met 5 months ago here in London, I stopped off in Canary Wharf, which is the kind of high-tech IT back room, if you will, of the financial district. I mean, it's sparkling and brand new. It was quite empty the day I went because they were concerned about protesters. I came across two bankers having a cigarette outside, and I said, well, I'm on my way down to the G20 summit meeting place, and, you know, what do you think is going to happen? And they were really dismissive, and they said, look, whatever these guys do, we're smarter than they are. We'll figure a way around that. And there's nothing in the last 5 months that has made me think that they were, you know, they were bragging, but that there was something underneath that, because, you know, you've seen that banker bonuses have returned to 2007 levels and so on. And it's hard to imagine how, you know, President Obama, who's got enough problems just getting very, very modest reform of the healthcare system through Congress, is somehow going to put in place regulations on Wall Street that will, you know, shrink Lloyd Blankfein, who's chairman of Goldman Sachs, will shrink his pay packet by very much. So I'm very skeptical.
I mean, you described something pretty interesting there. The financial community views the G20 leaders as a kind of committee of dullards. Protesters are certainly common at all of these G20 meetings, but I'm imagining from the general perspective of citizens, middle-class citizens in Pittsburgh struggling with the recession, that the G20 look like their own sort of conspiracy of bankers and plutocrats trying to take over the world. And whether they protest or not, it would reinforce a lot of cynicism there in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so this could make a big difference for Pittsburgh just by being in the news. Michael, if summits like this are not effective, what should we be doing instead?
Well, since we can't say we should have a global government, there's really, you know, very little to do except hope that the two main homes of the financial crisis were New York and London. So basically, we're reliant on the U.S. and the U.K. governments to use the means at their disposal, mainly the tax code, to try and curb banker behavior and make sure that our tax money doesn't go into their pocket.
So maybe the cities themselves have to step in. Michael Goldfarb is a Global Post correspondent. And if the world leaders were coming to your town, what would you say to them, a protest sign or a welcome banner? We're looking for what you would say. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Okay, name a public forum, an august public forum that changed history. It's a short list, really. You've got the good old Roman Senate.
How noble this looks from the outside. I don't like the color of it. Crassus is the only man in Rome who hasn't yielded to Republican corruption and never will. I'll take a little Republican corruption along with a little Republican freedom, but I won't take the dictatorship of Crassus. I've no freedom at all.
Later on, you've got the British Parliament, the U.S. Senate, of course, the Soviet Politburo, the Chinese People's Congress. Those two weren't exactly democratic. But for global diversity, you just can't beat the United Nations General Assembly.
Without peace, all our dreams vanish and are reduced to ashes.
That's Indian Prime Minister Nehru at the General Assembly back in 1960. He was then leader of the largest democracy in the world and also the leader of the then so-called developing world. Much has changed since 1960, of course. Today, India is an industrial democracy, while once superpower France is something less than super. Here's French President Nicolas Sarkozy speaking yesterday through a translator.
We are right in the middle of an unprecedented financial and economic crisis. We are on the threshold of a planetary ecological disaster. We must, right now, invent a new world where the follies of yesterday will no longer be possible.
Apparently, France becoming a nuclear power might be considered one of those follies. This week's speeches at the UN were dominated by references to nuclear proliferation. Here's President Obama giving his first speech as president to the General Assembly.
In their actions to date, the governments of North Korea and Iran threaten to take us down this dangerous slope.
But all of the 192 world leaders get to speak before the General Assembly. They come each with their own pet issues. For Swedish Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt, it was free trade.
Globalization is good. Through globalization, hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty.
For Lee Myung-bak, president of South Korea, also speaking through a translator here, it was climate change and developing green industries.
Thereby, we will not only transform our economic and industrial structures, but also change our very lifestyles to become more future-oriented.
Also giving his first speech to the UN General Assembly was Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He had a lot of pet issues in his rambling 90-minute speech. The release of former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, an investigation into the Vietnam and Korean wars. He insisted on $7.7 trillion in reparations for African nations which had been colonized. And swine flu, Gaddafi says it's a biological weapon gone mad. But he made history by being the first leader to discuss his own conspiracy theory about the Kennedy assassination.
The assassination or the killing of Kennedy in 63 or 62, President of the United States of America. Why? We want to know who killed him.
Speaking through a translator there, of course, the Warren Report, nonsense. The Gaddafi Report, well, all trails lead to an obvious culprit.
Jack Ruby, an Israeli, killed Lee Harvey, who killed Kennedy. We have to open the files.
How noble this looks from the outside. I don't like the color of it.
1 week, 192 speeches. Our little planet has only one global forum, the UN General Assembly. It may not always be pretty, but it's all we've got for now.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, how could your cell phone service be better? The FCC has some ideas on that. And we're also talking about Pittsburgh this morning as world leaders descend on the city for the G20 summit. But if they were coming to your town, would you lay out the welcome mat or hold up your protest sign? Your message to world leaders at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 47 minutes after the hour. Jobs are one topic at that G20 meeting. Fresh numbers are out just a few minutes ago about employment here. New jobless claims are down. The new numbers are better than forecasters predicted, so some good news there. In about half an hour, President Obama heads a UN Security Council meeting on reducing nuclear weapons. After that, he'll meet with leaders about Pakistan. Then it's on to Pittsburgh for that G20 meeting.
Major news in AIDS research out this morning. Scientists say for the first time they've discovered a vaccine that may prevent HIV infection. Researchers say testing shows it could cut infection by nearly a third. Investigators are expanding their probe into an alleged terror plot. They're reviewing phone records to try to ID new suspects. That as three suspects in Colorado and New York are back in court today. A Russian billionaire has a deal for a new toy. It's an NBA basketball franchise, the New Jersey Nets. The tycoon is dropping $200 million for a majority stake in that basketball team. The deal would make him the first NBA owner outside of North America. And the Nets, as you may know, are on their way to Brooklyn. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Could we be close or getting close to an HIV vaccine? News early this morning from a 16,000-person, six-year trial in Thailand. An experimental HIV vaccine has for the first time cut the risk of infection. Joining us is Donald G. McNeil, Jr., science reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Donald. Tell us a little bit more about how this six-year test was conducted.
Well, this was an incredibly complicated trial. It's the biggest of an AIDS vaccine in history. This is not like, you know, testing a flu shot. Half of the 16,000 men and women in the trial got six different shots of two different vaccines. The rest got placebos, and then both groups were followed for 3 years, given AIDS tests regularly. And at the end of the 3 years, 74% of those who got placebo were infected with AIDS, and only 51 of those who got the vaccine were infected with AIDS. It doesn't sound like a very big difference, but scientists say that statistically this is a significant enough difference so that they can say it means a 31.2% lesser chance of getting infected with AIDS.
But can we be sure that this is accurate and that we can replicate it?
Well, I mean, replicating it would take another $100 million, another 6 years, another 16,000 people. It would have to be done in another country because this was specifically tested against a clade of the HIV virus that circulates in Southeast Asia. You'd want to test it in the United States or in Africa. They both have different clades. So it would be very hard to replicate. It would be hard to replicate, but it would be expensive and take a long time. But what it does is it's fine to say it basically opens a door. For 20 years, everybody said, you know, there's never going to be an AIDS vaccine because the AIDS virus attacks the very part of the immune system. The trick, if you could, you can't really knock that out. effectively because a vaccine is meant to mount an immune response. So this shows, even though they don't know why, that it might be possible. They don't know how it works, but it sort of shows.
That's good news in on its own. Donald G. McNeil, Jr., New York Times science reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From the technology in the biological world to connectivity in the phone company, here on our tech segment here on Thursday, we're going to talk about the curious contradiction in the cell phone that you carry around with you. Sure, it's portable. You can carry it everywhere, but you can't change your service. You can't move from provider to provider, and it creates some restrictions and some rage as far as cell phone users are concerned that the Federal Communications Commission is attempting to deal with. New FCC rules proposed earlier this week could change how well your phone works and what you're able to do with it. It's a tech problem and also a legal problem, and here to talk about it is Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University and chairman of Free Press, a media reform organization. And also joining us is Eric Krangel, a freelance tech journalist.
Good morning.
And also Eric Krangel, a freelance tech journalist, is in the studio. Good morning, Eric.
Hey, John. Great to be back.
First of all, Tim Wu, what is the stage of our enslavement, and how do we possibly get out of it?
Well, the big difference between cell phones and your home phones right now is when you have a cell phone, you are basically tied to your provider. It's very difficult to move your phone around. If you have an iPhone, for instance, you're basically with AT&T.
You're with AT&T. How did consumers advocate their way out? Tim,
yeah,
you had a comment.
The deeper issue here is, like, how is it that we've gone sort of back to the way things were in the 1970s and 1960s, where you were basically stuck with... Now, there's more than one phone company. That's a big difference, but...
Well, AT&T, of course, the acronym of menace and loathing of telecommunications from way back, as you point out, Tim Wu. But here's FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski speaking about another acronym in the telecom world, the FCC.
I believe the Federal Communications Commission must be a smart cop on the beat, preserving a free and open internet.
So can the government, which deregulated telecommunications and created, in a certain sense, this mess back in the 80s and 90s, how does the FCC get us back to a situation where we can be more flexible, where the apparent portability of our cell phones can be an actual reality?
Well, I think part of the net neutrality issue is the whole idea sort of handcuffs to a certain extent how the telecommunication companies can control your phones. So, for instance, you know, there's a big push right now towards something called voice over internet telephone. So you can use a phone, a program like Skype, and you can make a free call over to the internet. Obviously, you know, for the phone companies, which also give you the device that connects you to the mobile internet, their interest is to make sure you don't do that. So, I mean, there's a real sort of consumer freedom issue.
We're only enslaved here in the United States. I mean, around the world, you can get unlocked phones that do all kinds of things. Tim Wu, how does the FCC get us to have more of an experience that the rest of the world is having?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that consumers, it's very simple, just need a few rights. They need the right to be able to hook up their phone to any network. They need the right to be able to access the full real internet. And they have the right to use whatever applications they want. Once consumers have those basic rights, once the FCC recognizes and enforces them, things will change dramatically.
You know, the restrictions that we have now remind me as though there were payphones all over the city, but you were only allowed to use certain payphones. In places like Mexico, where cell phone use is dictated by cash cards, it's a pay-as-you-go system, they actually have more flexibility, even though they don't have the convenience of being billed. Eric?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. And we've sort of seen, you know, more and more restrictions creeping into the system. So it's you know, we're at a place where things have been getting worse. And now the FCC has really sort of come forward and said, hey, you know, knock it off. We're actually going to really look at the issue of what rights people have as consumers when you buy a cell phone.
So, and how are we going to deal with, I'm in the situation, I just moved, and my new apartment, I have AT&T with an iPhone, and my apartment is in an AT&T dead zone. But I'm stuck in this contract. So how are we going to deal with this issue of contracts?
Yeah, these contracts have never been in consumers' interests, really. You know, there's this idea the phone is free, but of course it's not free. You just get it. You buy now, pay later, buy higher rates. I don't know. There's a series of practices that have gone on that are extremely hard to justify. We wouldn't accept them in other industries, but there they are.
But I guess... To have a situation where technologically your phone can do way more than your contract will allow you to do, That's just got to be something rife for being tested in a court of law, Eric.
Well, we're luckily at the point with the FCC where we're not going to get to that point, because that's precisely the issue you nailed on the head. Your phone can do all sorts of things. I mean, it's practically a small portable computer that you can put in your pocket. And, you know, we've been seeing some of the telecom companies, and some are worse than others, come in and really try to, you know, clamp down and restrict what you can do with these devices. And that's really what net neutrality is about right now.
Is there a nation that's doing net neutrality really well that people could maybe investigate, go online and take a look at? Tim?
I think Europe does some things very well. Korea is another country that does certain things very well. You know, no country's perfect. I don't want to pretend there's some utopia out there. But America, you know, when you have a tight oligopoly that controls everything, that's where we tend to go wrong. And we really have to watch out, because we've gotten that condition in the cell phone world, and we've got not just the FCC, consumers have to be aware of this and do something about it.
And there are millions and millions of those consumers with millions and millions of contracts in a gigantic industry with serious social implications. Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, chairman of Free Press, a media reform organization, co-author of Who Controls the Internet, and Eric Krangel, freelance tech journalist. Thanks to both of you.
Well, if you have a horror story about your cell service, or maybe you have a happy ending tale, we'd love to hear either one. Here's the number, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org for email. We're also talking about Pittsburgh this morning as world leaders head to the Steel City for the G20 summit. What would you do if you had one of those world leaders in front of you in your city? Would you welcome them with open arms? Would you protest and tell them to get the heck out? Let us know your message to world leaders at 877-8-MY-TAKE or again, mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you're looking for more bonuses to the show, we've got lots on the website, thetakeaway.org. We had recipes on there yesterday, and you can go get a great idea for a grilled cheese sandwich if you want to kind of mix it up there in the kitchen.
We have everything you need, full coverage of grilled cheese sandwiches here
the
at the
most complete coverage
takeaway.
Of any
maybe
morning news
we're making
news
too
show.
Much of the grilled cheese sandwich thing. Maybe we need to set it aside. I'm John Hockenberry, just thinking out loud, you know, sorry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
This is
The Takeaway with grilled cheese. On to victory. In the days of Andrew Carnegie, Pittsburgh was booming.
I speak for no one but myself when I draw for you a picture of the steel empire of tomorrow. What I envision is an organization, an industrial empire that would dominate the steel markets of the entire world.
But it's been a long time since the Rust Belt was shiny and new, and it may not be the place where you'd expect to meet some of the world's most powerful people.
Who knew you'd come to Pittsburgh and meet a celebrity?
Pittsburgh, drop down, let me see you shake it. Steelers won a Super Bowl, rubber in their face, long time coming, now we here, so congratulate us.
Gordon Brown, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the homies tear it up in Pittsburgh on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 24th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, a Russian billionaire buying basketball's New Jersey Nets, first time in the NBA. The Huxtables turn 25. The impact of the Cosby Show on television and society coming up.
But first, Justin Strong joins us from Pittsburgh. Justin, you've lived in Pittsburgh your entire life. So why is Pittsburgh the best place for the World Economic Summit?
Besides winning Super Bowls and Stanley Cups, that part's pretty easy. But I think we were kind of shocked when they picked us. But when you think about it, I think Pittsburgh kind of, in this day, age, and the economy is a perfect example how you reemerge from such a, you know, economic distress period. I mean, we went through losing a significant chunk of the region's economy with the whole, you know, steel industry.
Coming back strong, Justin Strong. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, Celeste, in the headlines, like Justin, President Obama will be in Pittsburgh for the G20 Economic Summit. In just a few minutes, he heads a UN Security Council meeting on reducing nuclear weapons. Fresh numbers on the job market this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits are down for a third straight week. The numbers are better than predicted. It could mean layoffs are easing. 530,000 people applied for jobless benefits last week. That's down by 21,000. 100,000.
And good news in AIDS research this morning. Scientists say a new vaccine could cut the risk of HIV infection by nearly a third. Dr. Seth Berkley heads the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative.
This is the first time that we've seen protective efficacy in humans, and so as you can imagine, we're quite excited about it, even though it is modest protection.
The vaccine trial was held in Thailand, led by researchers from the U.S. government and other groups, and Georgia residents are starting to head back to their flood-soaked homes. There's a massive cleanup job ahead for the southeast.
In Kentucky, the FBI is investigating the death of a census worker. A law enforcement official says the man was found hanged earlier this month. The word "fed" was marked on his chest. We're waiting for word from Massachusetts. Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, expected to name a Democrat to the seat once held by Ted Kennedy. Politico is reporting that the man's name is Paul Kirk, an official with the Democratic Party, but no confirmation yet. Wall Street dipped about 1% yesterday. The Dow opened at 97.49. The S&P starts trading at 10.61. And the NASDAQ begins at 21.31. Those are market-moving job numbers. The futures trading, after being down all morning, is now up. So if you're in Pittsburgh, what would you say to those world leaders who are keeping your city locked down and full of traffic gridlock? Would you welcome them? Would you say, come visit my restaurant? Would you say, give them a job? We want you to give world leaders at the G20 summit, if it was in your town, a piece of your mind. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. So we begin with the G20 Economic Summit. The 20 most powerful industrial economies in the world get together in Pittsburgh. And in the last episode of this little drama of the G20, you may recall it couldn't have been more urgent.
This is the day that the world came together to fight back against the global recession. Not with words, but with a plan for global recovery and for reform, and with a clear timetable for its delivery. And our message today is clear and certain. We believe that in this new global age, our prosperity is indivisible. We believe that global problems require global solutions. We believe that growth to be sustained must be shared, and that trade must once again become an engine of growth.
That's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown speaking in London last April. Are they carrying forward the mission there at the G20 as they gather in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? And they're certainly looking for engines of growth in Pittsburgh. In a sense, Pittsburgh is the birthplace of industrial capitalism, the home of Andrew Carnegie and Andrew Mellon, two of the richest people ever to walk the face of America. But Pittsburgh has certainly changed since then. And it's in the current environment that we invite Sabina Dietrich, Associate Professor of Urban Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, to the program. Good morning, Sabina. You're the historian amongst us, right?
Good morning, John. Somewhat of a historian, certainly in terms of some of the things that have happened to the Pittsburgh economy over the years.
And Sean Sebastian, you're a partner in Birchmere Ventures. You're the entrepreneur among us who's sort of a newbie in Pittsburgh, right?
Well, relatively speaking, I've been in Pittsburgh since the mid-90s, and actually I'm the capital source that funds entrepreneurs launching their companies, so I'm part of that community.
Great. And Justin Strong, we've already talked to you. You've been in Pittsburgh long enough to have seen just about everything, right, Justin?
Yes.
How long have you been there?
31.
And
31 years.
31 years. And there's never been a G20 summit anything like this in your 31 years, right?
No.
All right, Sabina Dietrich, let's begin with you. For historical context here, in some sense, it makes perfect sense to have the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. 100 years ago, Pittsburgh was really the center of industrial capitalism, along with Cleveland, to a certain extent, New York, Chicago. But Pittsburgh was really where modern banking and industrial sort of vertical integration began, right?
Yes, and as you mentioned, it was the home of Andrew Carnegie and Andrew Mellon, certainly the financial capital and the production capital through the steel and metal workings industry, glass, iron, and so forth, was really growing and thriving here in Pittsburgh.
Sean Sebastian at Birchmere Ventures, I mean, there was a time not too long ago when Pittsburgh, after New York, was the home of more corporations in the United States than anywhere else in the country. What are you finding there today in terms of seed capital and green shoots for economic growth?
Well, you're right. At one point, we had a very, very high concentration of Fortune 500 capital headquarters here. Well, we don't quite have that density now, although a number of notable companies are still based here. In contrast to that time, we're seeing a lot of younger companies, small companies with big ideas starting up, coming out of the universities that we think have the potential to supplant those and take their place in the larger global economy as leaders.
So, Justin Strong, what are people to make of the G20 being there? I mean, is the message to the G20, you know, industrial capitalism, love it while you got it, but it can sure go away. Just look around you in Pittsburgh. Or is it more, remember the good old days of Andrew Carnegie?
No, I think it's, learn from history, learn from your mistakes, but, you know, let's move forward. I think what, you know, Pittsburgh shows us that you can reemerge from these kind of distressed economic periods through innovation and new ways of thinking.
Well, you're the vice president of S&G Holding, a company for urban development of blighted areas. Let's get out of the boosterism here in this conversation. If you were to take Nicolas Sarkozy, maybe President Obama, possibly, you know, Hu Jintao on a little tour of Pittsburgh, where, Justin Strong, would you take them?
Well, actually, it's funny you said that, because on Friday at 3 p.m. we're doing a green environmental tour in the Larmer section of Pittsburgh, which is our company's first project. It's going to be based there, which is probably one of the more distressed areas of Pittsburgh. What we really want to show is the parallels between, even though you have like the top 20 economies, you know, hanging out in Pittsburgh for a couple of days, you still have a neighborhood like Larmer. So you want to kind of look at, they got the macro perspective. We want to look at the micro perspective of economy and say, you know, how can you outfit this neighborhood with its existing population while bringing in new demographics without pushing them out and put them in a path of opportunity to benefit from the new green economy.
All right. Well, Sean Sebastian, let me ask you a question as an entrepreneur. I mean, is Pittsburgh attractive because it's an opportunity to buy really low because it's depressed and has economic problems? Although some have said that it's actually done better in the recession than other cities. Or is there some unique asset in Pittsburgh that has real value?
Well, from a venture capital perspective, it has unique assets of two major universities that have very, very strong centers of excellence on medical on one side, University of Pittsburgh, and technology and robotics on the other side in Carnegie Mellon. And that's very hard to find anywhere else in the country, Silicon Valley included. On the buy cheap sort of perspective, we're off the coasts, and that is both an advantage and a disadvantage. We sort of are in the flyover area from the major venture capitalists and the major concentrations. But at the same time, it does, to your point, let us get into opportunities, we think, on a very attractive basis, and then have those guys follow us in farther down the road.
So, Sabina, you know, John was talking about it being a depressed place and asking what there is to offer. But, you know, Pittsburgh is actually quite a lovely city. It was voted most livable by the Economist magazine, I think, just a couple years ago. I mean, there's actually a lot going on. It's diversified its industries. But how does Pittsburgh emerge from this image of itself as a sort of rusting relic of the days of the Carnegies?
Well, certainly all the press it's getting through the G20 should help it. Absolutely. The transition is uneven, and Justin points out some of the neighborhoods in Pittsburgh where the transition from the old economy to the new economy has adverse effects on certain places and certain people. And it's always important to remember what those places and people are and what other kinds of things can be done. But in terms of the image of the city, I think the kinds of things that are being promoted through this event and through the G20 press and the greening of the city and the physical environment and the kinds of buildings that are being built, and as Sean was talking about, the investments and the strength of the universities here points to some of the things looking forward in the coming years for growth and the transition to continue.
Well, Sabina Dietrich, you make an interesting point, and Celeste reminds us that Pittsburgh is actually a lovely city, but the irony here is that in the heyday of Carnegie and Mellon, it was a polluted mess. You couldn't breathe there. There were high incidences of tuberculosis, so the sun shining there is actually a sign of the departure of industries. Are the industrial strategies of today in any sense relevant to how Pittsburgh got its original wealth, vertical integration, mass scale factories, that sort of thing?
Well, it's hard to draw total parallels from some, you know, events from 100 years ago in the transition of the Second Industrial Revolution, the kinds of things that were propelling it, certainly in iron and steel and so forth. But there are lessons to learn, and really it was the formation of those sorts of companies. I mean, the U.S. Steel was a, you know, Carnegie Steel became a $1 billion company in one day with the purchase. So those kinds of things. But it is a different technology base today, and that's the kind of thing that will propel growth and new companies.
Sean Sebastian, what are you most concerned about G20 leaders making progress on? And is it anything that might affect your bottom line?
Well, they're operating and thinking about very macro-level issues. And I think to your earlier point, Pittsburgh has not done as badly in this recent depression that we've had. From our perspective, the city never seems to fly as high in the good days nor sink as low in the bad. And I'll take that as a net positive.
Huh. Leveling out the boom and bust.
Exactly.
Huh. Well, Justin Strong, I'll let you take us out. You mentioned that it would be important for the G20 leaders to look around and maybe recall the lessons of history of industrial capitalism. What are those lessons from your perspective, 31-year resident of Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think, we kind of see even more recently, like sometimes you can't be too big. And I think one of the things that Pittsburgh kind of shows that if you are kind of like in the middle, you're a little bit more nimble, you can change with the flow of the wind, you'll actually survive longer over a course of time.
And what about those Steelers, right, Justin?
Yep, we're about to whoop up on some Bengals, take out some aggression.
Speaking of the Rust Belt, Sean Sebastian, you got a line on the Steelers game this weekend?
Oh, clear win. This is an easy win. We said that last week, too.
Sabina, how about you?
I'll second Sean's point.
All right, well, we're united about one thing in this conversation, the Steelers rule. Sabina Dietrich, Associate Professor of Urban Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for being with us, Sabina.
No, it's my pleasure. Welcome.
Sean Sebastian, good luck with the venture capital business there at Birchmere Ventures. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Justin, I'm coming to Pittsburgh. I think we should hang out.
Well, I have a place to hang out. You come on down to the Shadow Lounge or Ava, two of my spots opened up in East Liberty.
All right. Justin Strong, co-owner and general manager of the Shadow Lounge, waiting for the G-Summit.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now some quick takeouts on stories that we're following this week. We're going to go to Todd Zwillick. He's the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, we were talking earlier about Olympia Snow getting irritated during the healthcare debate. There's some more irritation going on there over a deal the White House brokered earlier with drug companies. What's going on there?
Yeah. Hi, Celeste. Well, this story really goes back to 2004. Congress passed the Medicare Part D drug benefit back then. And when they did it, they took 8 million poor seniors who were getting their medications covered under Medicaid and put that coverage onto Medicare. So it's same drugs, same coverage, but way higher prices for taxpayers. And the deal, it really drove a lot of Democrats nuts. So today in the Finance Committee, a vote on an amendment to simply put things back the way they were in 2004, have Medicaid pay for the drugs for poor seniors, and that would save taxpayers an estimated $100 billion or more. So now the White House deal you mentioned. Earlier this year when President Obama was pitching health care and the debate was heating up, the White House was trying to get all the traditional antagonists onto the same page, get them to cooperate. And part of that was a deal with the pharmaceutical industry. The industry sort of volunteered to contribute $80 billion in rebates to make Medicare cheaper for seniors.
That was nice of them.
That was nice of them. But today's vote goes way beyond that deal. It sort of more than doubles it, close to triples it. Well, here's what some Democrats on the committee think of that so-called White House deal.
The White House cut a deal with the pharmaceutical industry. And in order to keep the package together, they think that they have to honor that deal. Well, I wasn't a part of that deal.
Senator Bill Nelson, Democrat of Florida, I wasn't part of that deal. This vote is supposed to happen today, and a couple of Democrats are expected to vote no. And Chairman Max Baucus is in a tight spot. He helped broker the deal with the White House. Meanwhile, senators like Chuck Schumer on the left say this vote is a bellwether. Is this health reform bill about doing what's right for patients and taxpayers or what's right for the industry? So very interesting.
Not that they need any more complications on the healthcare debate right now. Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
All right, and the Seattle Mariners, fans of the Seattle Mariners, are familiar with the name of Yamauchi as the deep pockets behind that baseball franchise. The Japanese owner of Nintendo is one of the owners of the Seattle Mariners. But now fans of the New Jersey Nets are going to know the name of Mikhail Prokhorov. He moved a step closer, Russia's richest man did, to buying a share of the New Jersey Nets or owning them outright by signing a tentative $200 million deal yesterday. Here to talk about it is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning. I think one of the stipulations of that agreement is that they have to move to Brooklyn. And that's what one of the problems with it is that the actual plans to get the Nets into the Brooklyn Stadium has been fraught with politics and discord on the ground level in New York, and that's a lot of politics that we don't even need to get into.
They were already on their way to Brooklyn, but the real estate developer who was driving that had some problems, so it slowed down. But Prokhorov would, in theory, be a catalyst for that for two reasons. Number one, he's got money.
Yep.
That helps. And number two, there are a lot of Russians in Brooklyn who might love to see a basketball franchise that has a little Russian identity to it. Basketball is a huge game in Russia.
I think a lot of folks will remember in the Olympics, the first time the United States lost in the Olympics was to the Russians. I believe it was 1972 in basketball. It was the first time the United States lost. So there's definitely a basketball identity within the Russian sphere. And in Brooklyn, there's an incredible amount. So that's a great point. I will say this, that his presence reminds me more of an Al Davis with the Raiders and of a Mark Cuban with the Dallas Mavericks, because you have a guy who he's a basketball player size guy.
He's a hands-on guy.
He's an amateur player, a basketball player. So I think actually that he might meddle a little bit too much in the affairs of the team, and we've seen that that doesn't really bode well for any sports franchises.
Although the Dallas Mavericks have done well with Cuban, as wacky as he is, right?
Except they haven't won.
They haven't won, right? Except for that, yeah. Except for that little problem. But, you know, you can go to the Nets stadium in Brooklyn eventually and see Prokhorov there in the stands. Aside from being able to maybe get borscht along with your hot dog in the New Jersey Nets, is this good for the NBA to have foreign ownership, foreign investors?
Well, I mean, in New York, you have also the National Grid is now owned by a foreign owner in Britain. So I think it's actually a trend.
The electric utility.
Exactly.
Right?
Sorry. Yeah. So I think it's actually a trend, and it's actually a good thing because the NBA is a very international league, and I think it reflects that. And if it expands the sort of the market and the quality of the game and maybe brings some new players in,
right,
I think it would be a good thing.
Well, basketball is as international as soccer or football, as most of the world calls it, way more than the NFL or certainly American baseball. Let's talk about women's basketball. WNBA playoffs were on last night. How's Detroit doing? I have to ask for Celeste.
Well, of course, Detroit. Detroit's all roads lead through Detroit. Yeah, the game was tied at the half yesterday, but then the Detroit Shock took off with it. The coach for Indiana Fever, Lynn Dunn, said, basically, I feel like Detroit played like a team that wanted to win the game more than we did. And if you've ever played any sport, then sometimes a coach at some point is like, you don't want to win. You don't want to win. And that, I think at the end of the day, Detroit really just wants this more than Indiana does.
All right, and what's next in the playoffs?
So right now in the Western Conference, Phoenix stole a game in L.A. against the Sparks, and the coach, Michael Cooper, who you might remember, who used to be a player for the Los Angeles Lakers,
yep,
he's a coach for L.A., he basically said the playoffs begin when another team wins on another team's floor. So now we have a serious series there in L.A. The Sparks are going to go out to Phoenix. And so if you're watching the WNBA or if you're interested in that, you should definitely go. It's going to be some great basketball.
It's like a break and serve there. Definitely they're moving on the West Coast. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much.
Hey, good morning.
And we're going to check in with you now. Take a couple minutes because you've been telling us a lot of stories and we want to hear what you're saying. Let's start up with yesterday. We talked about President Obama going in front of the UN General Assembly. Was he improving America's image to the world or are we still ugly Americans, and what is an ugly American anyway?
Good morning, Chris, White Lake, Michigan. I believe that an ugly American is an American that would get on national airwaves and bash fellow Americans. We are what we are. We're there to help. We usually get no help, and it's about time we started to stand together as Americans and quit trying to put each other down.
We're getting some great recipes from you on how to make a grilled cheese sandwich. No put-downs here. It's because there are new websites where you can actually change the recipes online. So, John, here's my takeway on
the grilled cheese sandwich recipes, yeah.
Apples. apples and cheese. They belong together.
Of course they do. No, it's great. A couple of great suggestions.
Yeah, and Megan emails that she uses Granny Smith's on her grilled cheese. And on our website, Jennifer writes, we put ours in the waffle iron, and it makes crisp little squares and puffy waffle-like goodness.
Yum.
We're also talking about how the government is trying to make your cell phone work better, and apparently it's desperately needed for iPhone users. Jerry emails, I have an Apple iPhone, and while it's a great gadget, the AT&T services don't work in my own apartment. I hear that, Jerry. And Nate emails, I have an iPhone. I take the train every day. I like to listen to your show on it, except between two train stations, I have no reception at all. Let us know what you think about your cell phone, your grilled cheese, or what's going on to the G20, 8778-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytakeoftheTakeaway.org.
Think of us as AT&T customer service. That's us. Yeah.
Oh, God, don't think about that.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, speculation on a replacement for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. Name is emerging. Who is it? We'll find out in just a few minutes. And here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. President Obama is chairing a Security Council summit meeting. It targets the spread of nuclear weapons. Later, the president heads to the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, where the focus there is the economy. Scientists say they've developed a vaccine that may cut the risk of HIV infection by nearly a third. It's the first time a vaccine has been shown to give even limited protection against the virus that causes AIDS.
The FBI is investigating the death of a census worker in Kentucky. A law enforcement official says the man was found hanging from a tree with the word "Fed" marked on his chest. In flood-soaked Georgia, the water's receding, but leaving a massive cleanup job behind. President Obama promises federal aid there. And finally, data from an Indian spacecraft show new evidence of water on the moon. Researchers say the amounts are small, but boost the notion that astronauts could use it as a resource. So some of the stories we're following this morning.
So no more calls, folks. We have a winner. Frank Phillips joins us, State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Who's going to replace the seat left vacated by the death of Ted Kennedy? There's been speculation all morning. Frank Phillips, you've managed to confirm who it is that at 11 o'clock, Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, is expected to name to that vacant Senate seat. Frank?
We have confirmed that it is Paul Kirk, as everybody has been thinking about for the last 24 hours, but that decision really wasn't made until last night, so we held off, and we're satisfied that that's the correct report at this point. Paul Kirk, the former National Committee Democratic chairman for the party, and also chief of staff for Ted Kennedy and confidant of Ted Kennedy for many years.
Now, there are two issues here. The Kennedy family apparently had been lobbying for Paul Kirk, and they'll be at the governor's press conference, which again takes place at 11 o'clock Eastern time. But is this a senator who basically has one job to do, vote with the Democrats on health care reform, or does he have a chance maybe to run in the special election next January?
No, there's been a resolution, and the whole purpose of choosing Kirk has been that he will not run for the seat. All the candidates that the governor considered, Governor Patrick considered, were bound and pledged not to seek the seat, and in the special election, which takes place in January.
So this is sort of unprecedented. It's really about someone basically hired to do essentially one vote.
It's one vote. There'll be climate change. Just to represent Massachusetts for that 5 month, or now it's a 4 month period, really, until January 19th, that we will have two senators down there on a lot of the, some of the controversial issues, and also to help keep Kennedy's staff together and work on constituent issues that are important to Massachusetts.
So it's part of really the transition away from the Kennedy era, which really goes back to the 1960s in that Senate seat. And Paul Kirk will be there to, in a certain sense, finish out the Kennedy agenda on all those issues, health care simply being one of them.
Absolutely. And the Kennedy era goes back to 1952 when Jack Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah, it's a traditional. This is the end of a big era in Massachusetts and nationally.
And Paul Kirk, former Democratic chair, will take us there. He will be appointed apparently at 11 o'clock by Deval Patrick, the Massachusetts governor, to replace Ted Kennedy. Thank you so much, Frank Phillips, State House Bureau for the Boston Globe.
You're very welcome.
So if you read Liaquat Ahmed's great book on the Great Depression of the 1930s, The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World, you would learn that finance leaders way back then ignored the elephant in the room. The gold standard wasn't working. Sticking with it caused a global economic collapse long after the 1929 stock market crash. So as the G20 gathers in Pittsburgh, we wanted to ask Liaquat Ahmed if there are any elephants in the room over there in Pittsburgh, and particularly if there are any parallels with the Great Depression as world leaders gather in Pittsburgh today.
Absolutely none. I mean, basically, the leaders in the 1920s were in the position of 18th century doctors who thought the best way to deal with a sick patient was to draw blood. And we haven't learned a lot in economics, but we have learned that you don't take a sick patient and draw blood. That just that makes the patient more sick.
Now, of course, there'll be lots of congratulations in Pittsburgh today, but I went back and read your book, and my question to you is, certainly the nations of the world, whether they're smarter or healthier today than they were back in the 1930s, are sticking with a kind of dollar standard. We're not in a gold standard, but we are underwriting the global economy by using the dollar. Is that wise at this point?
There's actually really no alternative to the dollar at the moment. So we're going to have to live with it and sort of work around it. But I don't think that's a problem. I mean, the problem in the 20s and 30s was there wasn't enough gold. The problem now is that there's probably too many dollars out there. And one of the reasons why, as you said, gold prices are going up is because people fear there's too many dollars out there and the dollar will go down, and therefore people are using gold as a safety mechanism. So we're going to need a much more balanced economy with less consumption in the U.S., less exports out of China, and the only way to achieve that is for the dollar to go down, and not so much against Europe, but against the Chinese currency, the renminbi, has to go up. So the dollar has to go down and the renminbi has to go up.
You started out this conversation saying there are no parallels. And I go with you there, and that the bankers today and world leaders today are much smarter. Yet, if they ignore the elephant in the room, and the gold standard was the elephant back in the 1930s, we're going to hit some bumps moving forward. And I just wonder who is in a position to help us then.
You know, I don't think they're going to ignore the elephant in the room. They're just not going to sort of headline it. They certainly talk about it in private. They need to move delicately because they basically have to agree about this. And it is a problem for China. I mean, China has a massive employment issue. And so far, the only way they've managed to employ the tens or hundreds of millions of people entering the labor force is through this export machine. And China needs to develop a sort of new economic model, but it's hard to turn on a dime. So that's what I think the debate is really more about, timing and rather than actually the direction the world economy has to go.
The world leaders in April, when they gathered in London, talked very much about this is a new step. This is a historic moment. We can't do business as usual. And not that we focus on Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran much for economic advice. He did say yesterday, it's no longer possible to inject thousands of billions of dollars of unreal wealth into the world economy by printing paper assets and developing severe budget deficits. In fact, is the lesson of the G20 that's the only way to move forward?
Temporarily. I mean, think of it as a tow truck that is trying to get us out of a ditch. We can't rely on it forever, but we can rely on it for a year or two.
Imagine that. The takeaway there is, at least for the time being, Ahmadinejad may be right for now. Liaquat Ahmed, the author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. Thanks, Liaquat. Now, coming up, name that tune. 25 years ago, The Cosby Show debuted. America hasn't been the same since. More on that show's impact in just 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
Whose home is yours? Whose home?
Those are protesters in France chanting no deportations. All this week, French police have been clearing out a makeshift camp in the northern port town of Calais, known as the Jungle. That camp is hundreds of illegal migrants there, mainly from Afghanistan, were living there. And the migrants had hoped to cross the English Channel and get into Britain. The BBC's correspondent Emma Jane Kirby was there to watch the police as they moved in and dismantled this camp. Emma, good morning.
Good morning.
So why was this camp made and others like it? Why are they there?
Well, basically, these migrants or refugees are desperate to get to Britain because some of them have relatives who are already in Britain and they'd like to join them. Others already speak a bit of English. But most of them say they want to go because they believe the services in Britain are good, that they could be helped. And also, we don't have a national identity card system in Britain. And they say it's much easier for them to get a job in the black market there than it is, say, in France.
Well, some of these people paid massive amounts to these smugglers to try and get them into France and then over the English Channel into Britain. And yet they got to these camps. This one they closed was called the Jungle. They got to these camps and the conditions there were just horrible. Here's one migrant talking about his life in the camp.
Jungle is not life. Is nobody help there. Is no clothes, no shower, no food.
So they were living in terrible conditions, some of them for months. Where do they go now? Are they going to go back to Afghanistan or wherever it was that they came from?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to say that these are desperate men. You are quite right in saying the conditions are terrible. I've been following some of the migrants for many months now. I've been into the camps. They are living in the most appalling conditions. It's like a little shanty town based on a landfill site. Basically, there used to be 800 men living there, one tap for 800 men, no sanitation whatsoever. You can imagine the smell of that place. Everybody has scabies. You don't just feel the fleas, you can actually see them. But what has happened now? 276 people were taken away from the camp when it was closed earlier this week. Most of the men have been taken to detention centres in the south of the country. They'll be offered the chance to apply for asylum in France. That doesn't mean they're going to get it. Or they'll be given help to return home, or they'll simply be deported. Now, there were more than 100 children in that camp. I met children as young as 12 who'd made the journey by themselves, unaccompanied, all the way from Afghanistan, because they are so desperate to start a better life in Britain.
Well, they've been living kind of a limbo there because Britain has said that it will not take these migrants. So what made the French move in now? Why did they decide to dismantle these camps at this moment?
Well, they always said they were going to do that this year. They said it was a shame of France to have men living on French soil in such appalling, degrading conditions. But they couldn't do it, of course, as winter set in. We're now coming to the middle of autumn. It is getting slightly cooler here, and they wanted to do it before it really started to get bitterly cold. What is very interesting, though, is there used to be 800 men in that camp. Only 276 were arrested this week. So where did all the others go? Already, some of them are back in Calais, sleeping rough now on the streets, but still determined to jump on those lorries to hide away in trains, trying to get to Britain.
Emma Jane Kirby, a BBC Paris correspondent, thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up,
I am your father. I brought you in this world, and I'll take you out.
It's been 25 years since The Cosby Show debuted, and we're going to talk about what the Huxtables mean today in just a few minutes. We're also talking about Pittsburgh as world leaders head into the Steel City. What if they were coming to your town? Would you lay out the red carpet for them, and would you protest and tell them to go home?
This is Dave from Detroit. If the G20 was coming to my city, I'd tell them to get out of their limos, get out of their $5,000 suits, and take a walk around in someone else's shoes who actually has to work for their money. Then maybe they'd have a drastically different view on the economy and the world and what their stupid decisions are doing to the rest of us.
Your message to world leaders, 8778-MYTAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here are some of the news stories that we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama will be in Pittsburgh for that G20 summit. Right now, he's chairing a UN Security Council meeting on reducing nuclear weapons. The council just unanimously approved a resolution calling for nuclear disarmament. Fresh numbers on the job market are just out this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits were down for a third straight week. That's better news than investors had expected.
Lots of news stories out this morning. Major news in AIDS research. Scientists say for the first time they've discovered a vaccine that may prevent HIV infection. Researchers say testing shows it could cut infection by nearly a third. News out of Massachusetts this morning. The governor, Deval Patrick, will name Paul Kirk, Democratic Party official, to replace Ted Kennedy in that Senate seat. And investigators are expanding their search for suspects in a terror probe that stretches from Colorado to New York, as those three suspects arrested earlier this week are back in court today. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, time flies. It has been 25 years since people first heard that theme music on The Cosby Show. That means I was 14 years old when that show debuted. It revolutionized TV, but it did more than that. It in some ways, revolutionized American society. Joining us today, our friend Patrick Henry Bass. He's been looking back at the show and thinking about how the show has aged and fared over 25 years. He's a literary editor for Essence magazine. Also with us is Ta-Nehisi Coates, writes for The Atlantic. But Ta-Nehisi, you also profiled Bill Cosby for the magazine last year.
I did.
So let's start with you. Tell me about The Cosby Show 25 years later. Not so much, let's not talk about it. Its value as a TV sitcom, I guess. But, you know, there's been a lot of people talking about the effect that the Huxtables had on American society. Is it turning out to be true?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. And that's a question that's come up repeatedly with the election of Barack Obama, and particularly with the image of his family and Michelle Obama and those beautiful kids and everything. But I always think that, you know, because the question is usually phrased, did Bill Cosby make Barack Obama possible?
Right.
And I always think that says more about the people asking the question than it does about Bill Cosby or Barack Obama.
How old were you?
I was nine.
Show? Yeah, nine. Right, exactly. Nine. Listen to that voice.
Having been at least 90 years old when The Cosby Show debuted,
right.
Around the dinosaurs, it was groundbreaking in so many ways. First of all, in terms of American television, there had never been images of African Americans the way we saw with the Huxtables. We have to remember that Amos and Andy was the first vision that white folks had of African Americans when they debuted in the 1950s. And the images shown in that show were so stereotypical, the NAACP had it removed in 1966. We had Julia with Diane Carroll in the late 60s. She never had a husband. Her husband was conveniently killed in Vietnam. We had Sanford and Son, who was a garbage man who had no wife. We had the Evans family in Good Times, who lived in housing projects, where the father was killed 3 years into the run of the show. We had Webster, who was this magical Negro child who had no family, who were adopted by white parents. And we had the Willises on Different Strokes, who were taken in by a white man on Park Avenue, almost like a pedophile in some way. This limousine.
You watch a lot of TV.
I am a pop culture person, correct? So when the Huxtables came on in 1984, first of all, no one gave it a shot at surviving. The sitcom had been declared dead. NBC had been declared dead.
Oh, yeah.
And it was going up against Magnum P.I., Tom Selleck, The Mustache, Hawaii. So the chances that white Americans will watch a sitcom with an African-American attorney and doctor and five kids was just, the chances of surviving were slim and none. And it saved NBC and saved the sitcom.
You know, we talk a lot about the effect that this had on African-American families and the way that whites perceive African-American families. But, you know, I think sometimes we forget the effect that this had for African-American women, what it did for their morale and what it did for those who view African-American women. This is a clip from Felicia Rashad.
Let me tell you something, Melvin. You see, I am not serving Dr. Huxtable, okay?
Okay.
That's the kind of thing that goes on in a restaurant. Now, I'm going to bring him a cup of coffee, just like he brought me a cup of coffee this morning. And that, young man, is what marriage is made of. It is give and take 50-50. And if you don't get it together and drop these macho attitudes, you are never going to have anybody bringing you anything, anywhere, any place, anytime, ever.
Yikes.
She sounds was like, no joke.
Sounds like Michelle Obama. Sounds like something she's seeing right now in the White House.
But this was really a surprising view of the African-American woman and mother and wife.
Absolutely. And what you saw with the Huxtables, they had four African-American women on the show, so they were very multifaceted. So you got to see the evolution of black women from Rudy, who was 5 years old when the show started, through Claire and Claire's mother, and many of the guest stars that would come on as well.
I remember Cosby's sweaters. I mean, I go back to the days when Cosby was on I Spy, so I'm way dated on all of this. And I guess for me, the big question is, why do Americans, and, you know, I don't have a judgment on this, but why do Americans look to television to reinforce identities in one way or another? I thought all the sitcoms, white or black, were distortions and in many ways just kind of sugar-coated examples of reality. Ta-Nehisi?
I don't know. I think that's generally a bad idea. And I say that, you know, as much as I love the Cosby Show, I think it always bore the burden of, and any show in that time, of representing all of black people, which I think was always just a little too heavy to carry.
But I just want to say that it's in one's living room. Right. And so yep. your living room is one of the more intimate places in your home. And the living room is where people really have honest discussions. So when people have a frank discussion outside, it's not what mirrors often what's happening inside one's home. And so the choice to watch television and to invite whomever it is in your home, whether it's My Favorite Martian or the Beverly Hillbillies, is a big decision by a family. And I think what made the Cosby Show so successful was it was the anti-sitcom that played a lot on the nostalgia of the 50s, but it had a beat and a tone and almost a look and feel unlike anything on television at the time. It's quite sophisticated.
So, Ta-Nehisi, you know, one of the things that I know my own family appreciated was that they finally got, you know, they wanted to identify with some of the characters that they watched on TV all the time. And for them to see a show in which there were people who were not poor and struggling was something closer to their own lives. Here's another clip.
I just think I'd be much better off if we didn't have so much money.
No. You're using the word we. See, now, if you don't want the money, then you just tell us that, and we won't give you any. All right? And then all you have to do is pay us back the $100,000 you owe us, and we'll be even.
I mean, although I don't think any of us in our family were assuming that this is what all African Americans families were like, but it was nice to see somebody who was at least middle class, if not upper middle class.
It was, but you know, again, I feel hobbled by my experience. I think The Cosby Show was a lot more shocking for people who did not live in a diverse African American community. And I guess look to TV to reinforce that. I'm hobbled by my own autobiography. We didn't have a TV until about 2 years before The Cosby Show actually came on.
Wow.
So I always looked at it as a great show. I mean, I thought it was hilarious. But I knew middle-class African-Americans. I knew poor African-Americans. I didn't expect The Cosby Show to represent me or to, you know, be anything more than it was. Great entertainment. I don't say that in a demeaning fashion at all. I mean, it's quite an accomplishment to last as long as The Cosby Show did. It's a great show. But I didn't really take it anything more than that. I didn't look to it for sociology.
Well, one of the things it did do is spun off several other shows.
Yep.
Like there was Flip Wilson's show, Charlie and Company, which lasted only a season, but it gave us Jaleel White, and Jaleel White went on to Family Matters,
right,
which was a
right,
Cosby
right.
Show ripoff, and gave us our first African-American nerd on television.
You know, we got to go, but the most important thing I think you said this morning, Patrick, is that people watch television in their living room and watch Cosby in their living room as a family. We don't do that so much anymore. So in many ways, TV has changed because it's less of a social forum. They're on the couch watching the sitcom.
Yeah, I agree totally. You're not watching Weeds with the kids.
Yeah, and then Matrix downloads. Yeah, you're watching those by yourself.
Right, that's Patrick Hearn-Vass, book editor at Essence Magazine. We also had Ta-Nehisi Coates. He writes for The Atlantic Magazine, and he wrote a profile on Bill Cosby for the magazine last year.
So I'm wondering who listeners think they are, today's Huxtable family. Which TV family is as lovable or influential as they are? Or is there no one? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is there a TV sitcom family that matches the Huxtables?
Whose sweater rack matches Bill Cosby's?
Yeah, nobody's, man. Those are some serious sweaters. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway, our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Huckenberry. I'm not wearing a sweater, and I'm not as old as Bill Cosby, but this is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.